This is Heather Bachman for the first edition of Conversations with George Landreth, President of Frontiers of Freedom. George, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Heather. How are you doing?
I'm good. Let's start with the topic. The topic today is going to be Obama's legacy. Obama's legacy has been debated, especially with the recent issue of Sestak and Romanoff, but I want you to discuss it on more of a policy level, because I think that's where it's going to really angle towards when it comes to his reelection as well as his next coming of legislation.
Well, I think you're right about that. I think that some of these issues are big in the papers today, but 10 years from now, unless there are convictions, criminal convictions and things like that, people will long forget about, job offers made to Joe Sestak or, quite frankly, to Andrew Romanoff. I think those are issues that dominate the headlines today, but in truth, as history looks back on them, absent criminal convictions or some other sort of major, law enforcement investigation that really reveals unsavory things, my guess is this blows over and it does not affect his long-term view, how he's viewed in history. I think you're right about that.
What do you think is going to be, if and when he is not reelected, what do you think is going to be his next steps? Do you think his political career is pretty much over? Do you see him being a lecturer as George W. Bush is and an author? Or do you see him just returning back to Chicago and pretty much becoming just a point in history?
Well, I think when he's... it's hard to say, first of all, whether he'll be reelected or not. I think today it's not looking good, and there's no question that his reelection is less sure today than it was the day after his election. There are people talking about permanent realignments and, all these sorts of things, and the truth is that appears to have been a lot of hot air. Now, the other truth, though, is I don't think that the re-election of Bill Clinton looked that promising heading into the 1994 elections either. He was relatively unpopular, and he managed to rebound. He spent a lot of time triangulating and moderating and was able to kind of fix his relationship with the electorate. This president, I'm not clear he'll do that. He seems to be doubling down on everything, and he seems to be much more a true believer in terms of the things, you could say it was an advantage that Bill Clinton had, was I don't know that he believed that much. He just believed he liked being president. And so for him to moderate was simple because he didn't have to give up much. My sense is that Barack Obama actually believes this stuff, and he really does believe that statism works and that big government's the solution to our problems. And he's, honestly distrustful and disdainful of free markets and things like that. So he may very well just continue on the same path he's on because it's what he believes. It's too early to tell. But if the election were held today or this November and it were the re-election bid for the president, I think he would lose, and I think he'd lose badly. And so then the question would be is what would he do? He's a young man, so I don't think he's going to just go into retirement and do nothing. At the very least, he lectures. I think he continues to be an important person to at least, 30 to 40% of the United States in terms of people who, considered him, a good leader, whatever it is they like about him. I think most people will view him the same way they view Jimmy Carter, which was a failed president. One whose policies ultimately, Jimmy Carter was personally, I think, probably well-liked. I think people considered him, a nice fellow, a guy they'd like as a neighbor, but they came to the conclusion that he was a really awful president because he lacked leadership skills and he believed the wrong things, and so he took us in the wrong direction. And I think that's ultimately, that will be the fate of Barack Obama, except that it'll be in all caps. He, so much more than Jimmy Carter, believes all the wrong things and is taking us in all the wrong directions, and he's prescribing all the wrong solutions to problems that he is misreading and misdiagnosing. So he's misdiagnosing and he's also misprescribing, and that makes for a really, really lousy doctor, and it makes for a really, really lousy president. I suspect that's where he'll be.
Well, let's return to the subject of today's show, which is Obama's legacy. And I want to talk about this, obviously, in current times towards the future. What do you think Obama's legacy is going to be reflected upon when it comes to the BP oil spill?
Well, In fairness, he's not responsible for the spill itself, obviously. He wasn't out there. He didn't do that. I think, in general, he'll be probably criticized for being fairly uninvolved early on. I think, I don't know why uninvolved. Because, sure, BB's responsible. Sure, they need to pay for the cleanup. But it's in waters. It's under federal program. There's a whole variety of reasons why the federal government should have been more proactive early on. And I don't necessarily mean in terms of all this kind of silly talk about boots on the necks of BP and stuff. That just kind of is a fairly unsavory metaphor, in my opinion. But in general, just I think it was apathy. And I don't know if it's because of the president's desire for calamity, because he's already expressed, and Rahm Emanuel's expressed, that crises should not be wasted but used to a political advantage. So I don't know if their thought was we can use this to our advantage or what, but clearly early on they were twiddling their thumbs and doing very little.
Speaking of the aspect of political advantage, a lot of people are attempting to actually blame this on the Republicans through the phrase drill, baby, drill. However, you also have to look at the aspect of March, when Obama was the one who started discussing trying to get off offshore drilling. So who do you think, in the way of trying to pull the wool over the eyes of the American and saying that it's the Republicans' fault, do you think that's going to be positive for Obama, or do you think he's just going to be seen as somebody else who's pointing fingers?
Well, I think his track record of pointing fingers is now become kind of the subject of late-night television, the joking about how he's always blaming Bush. I mean, even to this day, just last week, he gave a speech, and he builds into each speech not-so-subtle digs at George Bush, and I just don't get that. I mean, we're now into the election season, so we're fairly far removed from George Bush, and at some point, I don't know, I mean, let's assume he won re-election and he's serving in his sixth and seventh years. Will he still blame problems on George Bush, or will he begin to accept them for himself? I don't know the answer to that question, but in no point that I can recall in modern history has a president spent all this time blaming his predecessor. You know, when George Bush took office, within months of him taking office, 9/11 occurred. Almost all the planning, when we look at the intelligence for that event, almost all the work that was done to make that happen was taking place on Bill Clinton's watch. And yet, if you go back and listen to his speeches, I don't recall him blaming Bill Clinton. He didn't really get to the issue of blame, because I don't think he wanted to blame anybody. He just knew he had a problem to solve. He was the president, he had to solve it. There may have been some talking heads who blamed Clinton, but I don't recall hearing George Bush do it. And he certainly wasn't doing it 2 and 3 years later. And you look at all the different things that have occurred. Every president has had problems that were arguably had their roots in a time prior to their in office. But that doesn't become an excuse to fail, to refuse to exercise leadership and to step up. So I think that's one of his problems. And then, just in terms of the indecisiveness, during the election cycle, he looked to be calm and cool and collected. I think what he's looking like now is disinterested and indecisive. And an example would be the plan. They had a pre-written plan for all this sort of stuff. It was written by experts a long time ago. And one of the first things you do in an oil spill is you burn the oil. The EPA stopped them from doing that because they didn't want them to burn it. So now it's floating up on shore. If they burned it, they could have gotten rid of most of it, but they didn't. There's a number of other things that kind of went on where the White House actually did the wrong thing. The administration did the wrong thing and messed things up. So I think as time goes on, he will bear more and more responsibility for the current problems, both because of a failure to lead and to the extent they took actions, they took the wrong actions. And that's been the consistent, I think, thing in this presidency is not just a failure to act, but almost incessantly doing the wrong thing at the wrong time and making things worse.
Speaking of taking responsibility, what do you think Obama's legacy is going to be with the inactive attempts to take partial responsibility or take no responsibility for the alleged offers to Sessak and Romanoff for dropping out of their races?
Well, again, I think this is in politics today, it is very in vogue to stand up and say, I accept responsibility. And then the rest of the speech is designed to not accept responsibility, but to divert it, to shift it, to have someone else, you know, bear that responsibility. So it's just kind of odd because this I bear responsibility is a political phrase used to look like a leader, but almost everyone who says I bear responsibility doesn't. I mean, that's almost a given in today's politics. So on some level, it's clear they're not, because you can, you know, judge them more by their actions than their words. And what you find is that they've done an internal review, and Robert Gibbs, the White House press secretary, wants us to trust his assessment that nothing untoward happened. And yet, if nothing untoward happened, it would seem to me they'd be more willing to give us facts and information. And they've dribbled it out slowly, been very careful about how they phrase things. They've parsed words. That's the behavior of someone who's hiding something, not the behavior of someone who's being open and honest. So I think he has two problems here. One is, did they break the law? And that's obviously a big issue, because people go to jail when you break laws. And then the second issue is, even if they didn't break a law, they can skirt that issue. He has a fundamental problem, which is he promised us over and over again that he would set aside this sort of sleazy politics, and he referred to the politics as usual and all this other stuff. And he was this new, super transparent, super honest, super great guy. He was going to just be like, you know, Mr. Uber honesty. And what we're finding is that is ridiculous, that there's nothing remotely close to that level of transparency. This is a very opaque president. And so what we know is that I think will have its own impact on him and his legacy ultimately, because I do think that there is this growing sense that the honesty we were promised doesn't exist. And you saw the same thing with Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton promised to be the most honest, most open presidency ever. And, of course, that was very rapidly became kind of a joke. And maybe people don't care about all the different scandals at this point. But if you go through the history of the travel office and all the other things and all the cover-ups and the hiding and it was thuggery and it was politics. Not as usual, but worse than usual. It wasn't just the norm that you would see in politics. It was the sleaze just dripping from everything. And I think that's what you see growing here. And it just reminds me, my grandfather once told me, when a guy starts telling you how honest he is, hold on to your wallet, because he's picking your pocket. And I think that's what, you know, we had this guy telling us over and over again how honest he was, and our natural reaction should have been, we all should reach for our wallet and realize we're talking to a con man. That's what con men do. They tell you how honest they are.
Absolutely. You were talking about the structure of the presidency and the administration, i.e. Gibbs, who, according to the Daily Caller, is pretty much just protecting the president. That's what their title page is right now. I am just reading this book called The Blueprint, called by Ken Blackwell and Ken Kalowski, and it discusses czars, and it states that, you know, that all presidents have a small amount of czars, but President Obama has the largest amount of czars in history. How does that reflect his administration to you, and how would it is it going to, as we said before, affect his legacy when we have so much control done within a, as you said, an opaque administration?
Well, on one level, I think it will make no difference in the fact that nobody besides people like you and me will care how many, quote, czars he has or doesn't have. But this is how it will impact, and it will be very important. When you are a president who believes in the power of government and believes that the government is the answer to solutions, so that every time you perceive a problem, your response is to promote a government-based solution, and it's not just government being involved in some way like a court system which imposes fairness or, you know, adjudicates disputes, but in fact the government is the one telling everyone what the solution will be and how it will be done, etc., then these czars become very important, because they become a means, and you look at some of the czars he has in place, and these are people who are absolute statists, who do not believe what the founders believe. They do not believe in individual liberty. They believe that the government is in the best position to make choices on our behalf, and that it is foolish to allow individuals to make choices for themselves. And so when you look at who some of these czars are, what their agenda is. It helps you understand that Barack Obama is a radically different sort of leader, and it gives you an insight into what his politics are. And his politics are at stark variance with the average Americans. And it helps people understand, when you understand the big picture, then you understand why he's always apologizing. Because he's not proud of America's history. He thinks America's a screwed up country. And so he wants to bring these people that have these diametrically opposed views in to change things and to get America more in line with the way he thinks it ought to be. And most Americans, if they were to wake up and you know, after a period of time and see the America that Barack Obama hopes to build, would be disturbed. And I think you see that now, because in Barack Obama's America, government will make choices about your health care, not you, despite all this talk about, you know, doctors and, you know, we won't get in the way, etc. That's all, quite frankly, a bald-faced lie.
Let's look at the aspect of safety. Obama has done a lot for nuclear arms in the way of reducing, as well as, obviously in many ways, halting creation of nuclear arms for Americans and trying to create treaties with other nations. What do you think is the international reflection to this in the way of America's safety in a time of war?
Well, I don't think America at this point reducing its nuclear weapons makes America safer. This is the problem with agreements with other countries, is we tend to keep our treaties and they tend to break theirs. So I don't understand the real advantage to treaties, quite frankly. I'm very suspect of them because Russia and North Korea and China are all inveterate treaty breakers. So it ends up being a unilateral agreement. We agree to do something and they do very little, or pretend to do something, or do a tenth of what they said they'd do. So it's just, my point is if you had someone that you were contracting with, that's ultimately what a treaty is, and you knew that person was a crook and a thief, and that if you paid them money, they would never actually perform the service, paint the house, fix the plumbing that they said they would do, you wouldn't enter into agreement with them, would you? And I guess that's my point, is I think that this is a guy who doesn't get that some of these other countries that he wants to talk nice with aren't nice. They aren't honest. They aren't in good faith. And there's simply no reason, when you make agreements with people, it ought to be premised on the notion that they are people of good faith. And yet he wants to sit down and talk with Ahmadinejad.
Mm-hmm.
This guy is clearly not a person of good faith.
You talked a little bit about the aspect of Obama's legacy in current events and in future. What do you think his administration's legacy is going to be, not just him as a president, but also the administration as a whole? You've already said that he is creating an America that we're not going to be able to recognize.
Or that he will, if given enough time. I mean, I think that a change in Congress this election cycle could prevent a lot of that. But if left to his own devices, absolutely. He would create, it is his intention to create an America most of us would not recognize or like.
Well, speaking as a former candidate, what is your response to the incredible number of electoral candidates, the greatest in history, as well as the greatest number of electoral candidates that don't even have campaign or political experience?
Well, I think that's probably a good thing, because I think democracy works best when it is vibrant and lots of people are involved. I think that even good congressmen and good senators are better when they understand the public is engaged and interested and cares and is going to hold them accountable. I think that that's, you know, democracy has to, as a premise, it has to have accountability, and I think this involvement makes it clear to elected officials that we expect accountability. So, one, I think it's a good thing. Two, I think it shows a lot of dissatisfaction, because I think the truth of is that as Americans, when we perceive things as going reasonably well, we're busy. We've got kids to raise, jobs to go to, education to accomplish or finish, friends to spend time with. We have a lot of things going on in our life. It's not as if we're just sitting around saying to ourselves, gee, I have 10 hours a week. What can I do with that time? Most of us are trying to find time to finish all the things on our to-do list. So when we perceive things as going well politically in the country, it is a fairly natural reaction that we become complacent because we take it off of our to-do list. It's like the toilet. When the toilet's, you know, plugged and not working, it gets on the to-do list, is to call the plumber or fix it ourselves. When it's working, we don't think about it. And it's the same thing with politics. And so I think that what this tells you is that it is another data point that tells you America is not happy. America is very upset. And the polls tell you that. The number of candidates tells you that. I mean, if somebody doesn't get that at this point is not paying attention, because the data points on it are legion. And but I think it's a good thing, and I think that it will rein in some of the abuses we've seen in the last year and a half since he took office and essentially nationalized the banking industry, Wall Street, the auto industry, and now they've even floated the idea of him nationalizing BP. You know, and I'm not happy with BP, but the government running it won't fix it.
I agree with
that. You know, that's the problem. Is that right now we can criticize BP, you can sue BP, you can do all kinds of things to BP. When the government's in charge, what do? And the answer is you just take it, because that's what happens. That's how government works. It's just too big and too powerful. People like talk about how big and powerful corporations are, and all I can tell you is nothing's as powerful as the federal government. So if you don't like powerful organizations, then the federal government should be the top of your list.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, George, for being a part of this program. This is Conversations with George. George Landreth, President of Frontiers of Freedom. For more information, please visit our website, www.fisandfrontiers, fisandfreedom.org.